Okay, the public safety, public safety, civil justice meeting will, you shouldn't confuse me with that name, will come to order. We do have a quorum, and Representative Kelly moves the minutes from February 18th and February 23rd. Any questions? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. The first bill we'll take up is House File 996, and Representative Tamar, I assume that you move House File 996, and I believe you said it goes to Public Safety?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it goes to Public Safety.
Go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 996 makes some changes to Chapter 25910 on changing one's name. And it's a relatively simple bill. It allows the court, in lieu of a personal appearance, to accept a signed and dated and notarized affidavit from an applicant and two witnesses testifying to the identity of the applicant that wants to change their name. As long as the applicant, under current law, is not trying to defraud or mislead the county. The bill requires the court to accept a notarized affidavit in lieu of a personal appearance in the court, and it allows the court to do so. This is all permissive, so it doesn't require the court to change their policy. Right now, at least in Ramsey County, the name change process is largely already an administrative one. The court receives a name change application. It reviews the file administratively to ensure that all requirements are met. It runs the background checks as required by law, and then it schedules it for a hearing. The hope here is, and we don't know how much savings would be, but in a time when we're all looking for ways to save money, we're hoping that this would be a step in the right direction, that it could save the court some money. It certainly would save the individual some time from having to go sit for several hours waiting for a hearing when much of this is really administrative work and would free up some judge time. Violation of this statute remains a gross misdemeanor. With me I have Mary Jurek, who's with the Ramsey County Civil Division, and she can explain a little bit more about the bill. We think it's a simple process, and again, it's all permissive whether counties want to enter into this kind of relationship.
Ms. Jurek?
Thank you.
Did I have the name wrong?
That's correct.
Oh.
Okay.
Go ahead.
When the applicant comes in to file their name change, we check all the paperwork, be sure that everything's filled out properly, accept the filing fees, open up the file, and then a hearing date is set in court. There's probably five to maybe six name changes on a court calendar each week. These cases are heard before a referee. So we're thinking that it would probably save 5 minutes per case, so you're talking 25 to 30 minutes per week by having these cases done administratively.
And Mr. Chair, just the applicant would still have to do everything that they're currently required to do. You have to fill out an application for a name change. You have to fill out your criminal history check release, and then the actual order. So all of this would be submitted by mail. You'd still have to have it notarized in front of two witnesses, much like you were having a will notarized. And then what we simply don't know, and these are some things that the courts are going to have to try out, is how much administrative time would go into this rather than having a hearing before a judge. But with this bill, we'd like to at least give counties the opportunities to experiment with some cost-saving measures. So if you look at the bill on line 2.5, it says it's all may. It's not requiring the courts to do anything different.
Okay. Are there any questions, Representative Holberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Tamar.
On page 2, it talks about except when the provisions of section 259.13 apply. What's that exception?
Representative Seymour?
That's 259.13. That's the provision of the felony. If someone has been convicted of a felony and is trying to change their name, under current state and federal law, they have to serve notice of application for that name change on the prosecuting authority in that county. So all of the current safeguards that we have in place relative to a felon trying to change their name or stays the same. So that's the reference in statute.
And if I might, do they do a background check on everybody that wants their name changed?
Representative Kamer.
Ms. Jarek, do you do one? Okay.
I actually send the criminal history form that's completed to the Sheriff's Department, and they run the criminal history check before the hearing is even scheduled. So that would be the same if we went with the administrative procedure.
All right, thank you.
That's all. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, on the outset, they have to reside here for 6 months. Do they also have to be a U.S. citizen to have this name change done?
Ms. Jurek?
To be honest, we don't actually check that. The statute and the procedures say that they have to live in the state of Minnesota for 6 months and do it in the county where they reside. We don't have them show proof of citizenship.
Okay, because that was...
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That would be my concern, is that what if someone is here illegally under the radar screen and, you know, does the criminal background check, maybe they don't have a criminal, a criminal record here in the United States, but they may in the country of origin. Mm-hmm. And then they come here and they go into this name change, and that's what concerns me.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Jurek? Or no response?
No response.
Is there any, Mr. Representative Westrom?
Maybe the author could share how he would feel about that. Maybe it's an amendment we should be clarifying in the committee. Representative Scott probably raises a good point. I think everybody would assume that they're citizens. But
Representative Tamar.
Yeah, I'm not, to be honest, Representative Scott, I'm not sure what the court currently does if the judge asks that question of people, or maybe Ms. Jarek knows. I mean, because we're not changing anything except the personal appearance, so...
Representative Tamar, it didn't used to, the courts, I haven't done one of those for centuries, but they didn't used to ask that question, the judges.
I have a list of questions that the referee uses, and I do not see that listed on the sheet. I know that they don't ask every single question on the sheet, but I, to my knowledge, they do not ask that.
Let's see, Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, this Representative Haymart, is that a friendly amendment that you'd consider just having us add into the statute to, rather than
presuming? Representative Haymart,
I wouldn't have... The staff would suggest that maybe we could do this if you would allow me in the next committee, so we can draft the amendment correctly. That the court could require a personal appearance in any case. Maybe we could frame that into a proper amendment so we do it right. It's going to represent Hilton's committee. I don't have a problem with it, is what I'm saying to you. I just don't know how to frame the amendment.
Representative, just, Tamar, just to be clear, you have no objection to an amendment that would say that that there'd be something in the form to ask that question then, or exactly? I'm trying to get some clarification. And I don't.
Staff is suggesting that if we just had some language in there, Mr. Chair, that the court could require personal appearance. So,
Representative Seymour, what would trigger that if it's not in the papers?
I think Mr. Chair, either way, you know, we're sort of in this bind here. It's whether the court currently doesn't ask that question of people. So the question is would it be any different if you had the documents notarized and sent by mail? You know, we could have some language that would allow the court to have that as part of the checkoff. If you know, maybe they should be asking. I don't know the answer to that.
Well, I think Representative Pima, that's what Representative Westrom suggesting, and we're kind of waiting for your response. Which,
yeah, I don't have a problem with trying to work out some language relative to this. I just don't think I can do it right now.
Is that okay with you, Representative West?
Well, I think so. Mr. Chair, I'm sensing maybe not the same conclusion as Representative Paymar. I think that should be a quick, rather than may, that should be a shall. It seems to me that should be a yes or no question, and if it's a no, if you're not a citizen, then it absolutely triggers something different. I guess that would be my concern or thought, but I don't know, Representative Paymar, are we on the same page, or are you thinking more loose for the courts if they decide to, or I'm thinking more of a shall that they have to?
Chair, maybe we should just temporarily lay it over. If you've got a couple other bills to deal with, why don't we temporarily lay it over, see if I can find some language that will satisfy the committee.
And yes, and Representative Paymar, I think it's going further from what he started off with now, whether or not it's a citizen, which is a huge difference from where he started.
So if we can do that, I appreciate that, if we can work it out.
We'll temporarily lay this over until you're ready to bring it back. We'll start the question list over when we bring it back. Representative Bigham's House File 130. Where did she go? She was here. Representative Hilstrom, do you want to move the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd move that House File 130 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Public Safety Policy and Oversight Committee.
Representative Hilstrom, bill moves House File 130 be passed and re-referred to the Public Safety Committee. Representative Bigham, do you want to go ahead and present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the committee for allowing me to come forth today. House File 130 was heard in last year, was introduced last year, and this is the second stop. This prohibits registered sex offenders from accessing social networking websites such as MySpace and Facebook. Last year, Representative Lesch brought up a concern talking about when maybe people are playing online games like in a poker room or a card room or whatever, and you can chat. There's an ability to chat while you're playing the game. He wanted that included too. So working with him, that is the difference of the bill this year. The other thing, you know, like I said, the previous committee, your first logical question is, hey, how are you going to enforce this, Representative Bigham? One, the industry is very good. You may have seen, I think a couple weeks ago, that MySpace purged 90,000 sex offenders off of their roles and or accounts. And then the other thing is a registered sex offender could be subject to unannounced searches of an inmate's person, vehicle, or premises, and we're extending that to a computer or PDA. So we're expanding already current language there. And I know that the other question may be, is there a fiscal note on this? The answer is no, because we put this out till August 1st of 2010, because every year registered sex offenders are sent notification letters, And the prosecutors asked, it would be nice to have clarification that they have been made aware so then they can prosecute, and also then it doesn't cost the state to send an additional letter. So with that, I can have Mr. Voigt from the Attorney General's office comment.
Mr. Chair, my name is David Voigt. I'm a Deputy Attorney General. Just as Representative Bigham said, just within the past couple of weeks, both MySpace and Facebook, the two largest social networking websites, have revealed that through their continuing efforts to remove sex offenders from their sites, they've removed tens of thousands of sex offenders. And they continue to search their sites for sex offenders. However, there is not a wholesale prohibition to prevent sex offenders from going on the website in the first place. And as an internet safety measure, that's what this bill proposes to do.
Mr. Voigt, I have a question on this. First of all, after listening to your testimony in the last one, and you said there was a difference between access or the other thing, create or maintain, etc. I thought there should be a comma before the first small I, but then our staff says it should be a semicolon there. Since you want to, from your testimony before, what you want this to do is read that persons required to register under this section shall not access, one, a social networking website, or two, an instant messaging or chat room, etc. So if that's what you want to do, which is what you said at the last one, then we should have a semicolon before the I, before the parens I.
Mr. Chair, we don't.
Oh, I'm sorry. Pardon?
We don't even know what page.
Oh, I'm sorry. On line 5.2, and I've just been informed by staff that he changed his mind. It's now it should be a colon, not a semicolon. I started off with a comma. He first said semicolon. I think he's right that it should be a colon there.
Mr. Chair, did you say before or after the I?
Before.
Before the I.
So that it shall not access those two things or create or maintain those two things. Is that correct?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I'll leave it to the grammatical experts whether that's the correct punctuation. My concern is that there is the requirement at the end on lines 5.3 through 5.5 that restricts this to websites that permit persons under the age of 18, and I believe the intent is that restriction apply to both I and II. And I don't know if that's going to require an extra comma or another punctuation mark.
And, you know, Mr. Swales would not be happy.
That obviously
right now
changes the meaning then from what is printed. So can counsel, while we're asking questions, can you come up with...
Let me come find Representative Swales. Maybe she... Just saying.
Can you... Okay. Representative Bigham, I've been informed that what we should do to get that exact meaning that you want, or that your testifier says is wanted, is we would put a colon after the word for on 5.2, change the comma on line 5.3 after the word site to a semicolon, and then put a comma after the word program on line 5.3. Is that correct? Yes.
I would move that amendment.
Okay. Well,
oh, I
can't. I'll move it
my
for
bad.
You. Okay. All in favor of that grammatical changes, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carry. Now we have some questions. Representative Champion.
Representative Bingham, isn't it possible that you can get to this particular desired outcome by making it a condition of the probation outside of it being a law saying that these particular individuals cannot use this particular form?
Who's the question? Oh, to Representative Bingham? Okay, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. Yeah, I'm not a probation officer or an attorney. I'm assuming you are correct that that could be another way to do it. But I think this is a consistent way to do it so that we know that we have a level playing field that maybe some counties aren't, you know, maybe some counties are implementing it and some aren't. So that's why I went this route.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Champion.
Doesn't this legislation prohibit a person from interacting with any other adults, though?
Representative Bingham?
Mr. Chair, Representative Champion.
Representative Champion.
For example, like this wouldn't prohibit somebody from accessing monster.com or any other data website for job application purposes.
Representative Champion.
A follow-up. Can you clarify the provision and why you wanted this particular provision that talks about unannounced searches and whether that would be in violation of someone's constitutional right?
Representative Bingham.
Mr. Chair and Representative, well, currently that is a possible subject of, you know, a probation. And this is a way to enforce it, you know, to make sure that if we're working with the industry to make sure that we are able to get at what we need to, if there is an issue, if there is a violation. And I probably will yield to the testifier here to answer that more thoroughly or technically.
Mr. Boyd.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the statute already provides for unannounced searches of a person, vehicle, or premises from someone on intensive supervised release. And those statutes like this have been challenged and upheld on constitutional grounds. This simply expands those unannounced searches for people that remain on supervision, and I'm confident that that provision would be upheld as well.
Has the court rendered any dicta around, you know, this area of expansion that you are seeking here?
Mr. Voigt.
Not that I am aware of.
Representative Campbell, any further?
So we don't know the constitutionality or how the court will rule on this expanded notion of infringing upon a person's constitutional rights. Would that be fair to say?
Mr. Voigt.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if the court were to conduct the same type of analysis for the computer or electronic devices as it has in other contexts, like a search of a person or a vehicle or a home, then under that same type of analysis, this should survive scrutiny because, in fact, the level of intrusiveness to a search of the computer or an electronic device is probably less intrusive than a search of a person or a person's dwelling.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bingham, you said in your testimony that, I wasn't clear what you were trying to say. If someone if a gamer is trying to talk to the other person that they're gaming with, because you can, if you're playing Grand Theft Auto, you can talk across the internet and instant message apparently on it, they wouldn't be able to instant message with this bill.
Mr. Voigt.
I think it was to me, Mr.
Representative Bingham.
And Representative Mahoney. If they were a sexual, if they were registered as a sex offender, and Actually, no, not Grand Theft Auto, because you have to be 18 years or older to buy it.
Represent Mahoney.
Well, that may be, you maybe have to be 18 to buy it, but you broadly said that they can't game, because they may somehow or another have a 16-year-old on a gaming site with them where they're playing with a half a dozen other people.
Representative Bigham.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, if an 18-year-old, and actually you're not, you don't have a personal webpage on, like, Grand Theft Auto, is the other thing I would say. You know, I think what Representative Lesch was getting at there is that there is the potential that kids could be playing online games, and I think he was talking about, I'm sure he's talking about like Texas Hold'em online tournaments, where you could know if that person is under the age of 18, or if that person is a sex offender, could have access to kids under the age of 18. And I think what Representative Lesch was getting at is that it was a huge loophole in the bill from last year, and so we implemented that this year to close it. But to answer your question, if they're not required to have them, if the computer program doesn't require you to maintain a personal web page, then the answer is no.
The answer is no, they can't.
In Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The answer is no, they can't play, they can't game online. Are you saying that with this bill they will not be able to game online, because if they have an instant message on that gaming board, they're not going to be able to play? And I mean, I don't play the games, but I just know how popular they are. I think you're setting yourself up. You're forcing somebody. Now, you're cutting out a lot. It's pretty broad here. And I understand your bill, no, you can't have an instant message or chat room, which could be defined as that game. So you're saying no. I mean, anyone that's a sex offender can't game online, period.
Representative Bigham. Yeah, I'm sorry, Representative Mahoney. I haven't had my coffee today, and I've confused myself mixing the two lines, the I and II. You are correct. If there is, if you and I were in a Texas Hold'em tournament, and one of us was a registered...
Mr. Chair, I don't care about Texas Hold'em.
Well,
I'm worried about the game. I'm worried about, like, Grand Theft Auto, which is probably the most popular video game ever. And if you are a kid from the age of 14 to however old kids are, you're playing Grand Theft Auto, and you're
this
gamer.
This is an adult soliciting a child, though. This isn't child to child, just so you know that.
Yes, done.
This isn't, we do have juvenile sexual offenders that are registered. This wouldn't be a 16-year-old affecting a 16-year-old. And
Representative Bigham, do you want Mr. Voigt to answer?
Yes.
Mr. Voigt?
Maybe I'll let the attorney answer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I'm also less familiar with these gaming sites as I am with the social networking sites. As I understood the addition of those gaming sites, it's that some of those gaming sites, I believe, have developed features that are similar to social networking websites, where the users create profiles and they have instant messaging and they communicate with each other much like they do in social networking websites. And I believe that's why that provision was added to the bill. Now the bill would apply to only sites that allow people under 18. Grand Theft Auto, I don't know what their restrictions are. I've seen what some of their content is, and if that particular game and that particular site is limited to only people 18 and over, then this would not apply. But for gaming sites that allow children to play, then this profile would apply if it's the type of game site that allows, it has instant messaging and chat rooms.
Mr. Voigt, just for your information, there's an awful lot of children playing Grand Theft Auto. I've never done it, but I know I work with the youth in the schools, and believe me, they're playing it, Representative Mahoney.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and Representative Begum, Mr. Blake, I'm not sure. I think the prohibition is against buying the game. I don't think the provision is against playing the game under the age of 18. You can't buy it. I'm not in favor of sex offenders. I don't want them on social network sites. I want them to be, you know, I want to protect our kids and everything else, but I think there's a, I think you're setting people up to just toss them back in jail. Pretty much here.
Mr. Chair, just before I have to clarify something, I said, again, because I haven't had my coffee this morning, I was confusing my other bill. This applies to all sex offenders. I know I had something about 18-year-olds. That was my other house file, so just wanted to clarify that.
Representative Mahoney, do you have...
As a mother of a child who plays Halo online, and a husband who plays Halo online so that they can communicate with, you know, other people who are playing the game, I don't want sexual predators being able to play Halo with my kid. And so I understand that, you know, the primary focus here is like the MySpace and the Facebook, but the game contact is even more involved than the Facebook contact, because Facebook, you've got time and space to respond later. The Halo stuff is like online right now. And so I don't see that as a problem with your bill. I see that as a good part of your bill. So as a parent of children, I don't want these folks on those gaming sites, whether it's Grand Theft Auto or Halo or Doom or whatever it is. I don't want them on there, and I don't think they should be able to be on there.
Representative Mahoney, are you done, or do you want to come back to it? Or
no,
I'm Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bigham, I just want to clarify who the predatory offenders are, because I think sometimes it's not always clear who we're talking about. The vast majority of folks that are convicted of sex offenses don't go to prison, but are put on probation in the community. What we're talking about here in terms of predatory offenders, if I understand the bill correctly, and you can help clarify it for me, is persons who have gone to prison for their offense, who have been released and then assigned a classification level of 3 or 2. Is that who we're talking about? Are we talking about
everyone?
Anyone who's been convicted of any sex offense, level 5 on them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, it's any registered sex offender.
Whoa.
So whether it's the 10-year registration, whether it's the life, you know, the life registration, it's anyone that is through their sentence has to be registered as a sex offender.
Ms. Representative Johnson, do you want to follow up? I do. If you don't, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Mr. Chair, well, and I'll think about that.
Well, Representative Bigham, that includes then the ones, for instance, that right now the county attorneys want to get off of that list. That would include those, even youth that apparently streaked once or something. I remember that used to be popular. No, I didn't. That was one of the things brought up at the meeting on the absurdity of where some of these things are going and the Adam Walsh Act and other things. Representative Johnson brought up an issue I'd never thought of until he brought it up. That would include those people then. Wouldn't it, Mr. Voigt?
Representative, this bill would apply to anyone who was convicted of an offense that requires sex offender registration. Indecent exposure, I'm not sure would apply here. That's the offense that would apply to streaking. but, you know, I think the point of the bill is that anyone that the law recognizes should be required to register as a sex offender should be subject to this prohibition. If under the sex offender registration law, the requirements for registration were changed. For example, less people were required to register, then automatically less people would be subject to this provision. And likewise, if sex offender registration was expanded, then more people would be required to would be subject to this prohibition, because this prohibition is equal to the requirement to register for as a sex offender. And that registration requirement, if I can go back a moment, applies to people convicted of offenses of the offenses on the list, whether they're sent to prison or whether they're placed on parole or probation.
Just to be clear on the issue that's probably going to come up, Mr. Voigt, then it would apply to those youth that the county attorneys and judges want us to take off of that right now, then? It sounds like.
Yes, if that category of people are currently required to register as sex offenders, then this prohibition would apply.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
I'll pass right now, Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott is next, then Drazkowski, and then Champion. Oh, quite a while ago. Okay. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bigham and Mr. Voigt, I'm looking at the infamous top of page 5 again, 5.1 through 5.5. The word permits, I just wonder, you know, who really provides the control or the interpretation here? An instant messaging or chat room that permits persons under the age 18 to become a member. What does the word permits mean? Are you talking about physically with your keyboard you are able to get in and create an account, or one that on their website or other media gives them written, written authority to do so. It seems to me that this could be construed to say, anyone that you are physically able as a 17 or 16 year old to get in and create an account.
No,
Representative.
When you register for Facebook or MySpace, they have you fill out a bunch of things, and they ask that you are, I think it's, if you have to be over the age of 14. This is an industry thing. If the web company, so Facebook, allows you to be under the age of 18, that's who's permitting you to create an account if you're under the age of 18. That's what it's relating to.
Representative Kelsey.
I'm still not clear, Representative Big.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm still not clear. I mean, that permits someone under age 18. I understand what you're saying, that there's a protocol in the industry, but there's also other websites that somebody under the age of 18 could physically go in with their keyboard and create an account. And I guess as I looked at that, they would be permitted or able to create it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski, it's the host of the website who allows you to do. That's what permits means. That's who is giving permission. So that's the answer to the question. I don't know if there's if Facebook says it's under the, if it's 14 and over. Then it's 14 and older is permitted to create a Facebook page.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bigham, so is there a point at which that there is a solid verification of that person's age by that website?
Representative Bigham.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, no.
Representative Champion.
Just for clarity, believe it or not, I don't get online very much neither. But so are we saying that any person who's able to, okay, let's say a person gets on Facebook,
mm-hmm.
and those who are eligible to get on Facebook and design their own page are those who are 14 and over, right? And so if that's true, you're saying even if a person who is a sex offender who gets on online and does a pay, so he or she's able to communicate with people around the country that they know, they may have grown up with, you're saying even if they have access or designed a page for themselves on Facebook for that purpose, if they are a registered sex offender, then you're saying they should not be permitted or allowed to do so.
Representative,
is that what this legislation says?
Mr. Chair, Representative Champion, yes.
Representative Olin.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just going to make a quick comment. I think the county attorneys aren't pursuing that piece of legislation that I had last year and this year.
Oh, okay.
And
Representative
Johnson. Just to clarify, Chair Mullery, for the committee members, if that law would come into place, then they would no longer be required to not be on Facebook or MySpace.
Right. Representative Johnson.
Just one thing.
One second.
I'm not here to follow up because I'm a new guy. I don't know what the law is that he was introducing from last year. So I don't know if we can have some clarity to that.
Senator Champion, there was a bill to take a number of youth offenses off of the register for sex offenders. The idea was that the judges wanted it and the county attorneys so they could handle those cases and get treatment for them, whereas judges didn't want to put them on for life for some of the things they were doing.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bigham, just for my clarity, then, if a person who is a registered predatory offender did create a personal web page in the manner that's laid out in this bill, what is the penalty or consequence when a probation officer goes and finds out that this occurred? Then what?
Representative Bigham.
I didn't hear the last half. You kind of phased out there in your mic.
What's the penalty if someone does do this, a registered sex offender, and a probation officer goes to the place and finds it occurred? Then what happens?
Representative Bigham.
Mr. Chair, I would assume because it would be a violation of probation, it would be a revocation of their probation, and I'm assuming
Mr. Voigt,
Mr. Voigt.
There is a general provision that any violation of the sex offender registration law could be the subject of new charges. And because, at least for someone who's still on supervision, they are all required to remain law-abiding. Because of that provision, they could also be subject to a parole or probation violation.
Representative Johnson.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have a couple questions. First of all, I'm not sure I fully understand. I think I know what you're trying to do, but I'm not so sure that the language here reflects it. And I don't know if it's your intent to not allow sex offenders to do any type of gaming or interaction with anybody online, if that's the intent of this, but I think it's going to be hard for people to understand what the parameters are, and if I don't know that you got the right words here to do what you're trying to accomplish, given what type of interactions there are on online gaming and different programs that you can do online where you take on a character or whatever, and I don't know how you ever monitor whether there's kids on there or not. But I wanted to, I know we've talked about this before, getting back to the bottom of page 5. It's pretty easy to identify who owns a vehicle and who owns a premise. It's not so easy to identify who owns a computer or a PDA. Is it your intent that this computers that will be subject to this will only be the property of the sex offender? Or will this language now subject computers owned by a sex offender's employer, a sex offender's neighbor, a sex offender's family member? We don't have certificates of ownership for computers or PDAs similar to a vehicle or a premise, so I'm wondering what your intent is with that.
Mr. Chair,
Representative
Wilberg, it's the person's computer. And also, when you log into these social networking websites, and every time you log in, the industry would be able to tell you that, you know, the times. Am I wrong?
Mr. Boyd?
Oh, okay. I thought you were shaking your head no at me. You'd be able to log into the account, and there's passwords, so.
Oh, and
Representative Holbrook.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bingham, I don't know that they know which computer or whose computer. I mean, I don't think that they know. I mean, I log on to my email accounts and et cetera from all different kinds of places. So, I mean, I mean, it sounds good. Oh, yeah, we can look on the computer, but I don't know that there's any teeth to this, and I think there's unintended consequences. And, you know, I mean, I like to have laws that make sense and are workable and don't cause adverse consequences for law-abiding citizens, especially law-abiding citizens that may be trying to provide support or help to people that need it. So I'm not. I mean, I think your intent is good. I think there's problems with your bill.
Representative Bingham, just to make clear, so something like Grand Theft Auto or a better game than that.
Like Wii Nintendo or something.
Yeah, would qualify as an instant messaging or chat room program, wouldn't it? That's my understanding. If I'm wrong, tell me.
Mr. Chair, that's my understanding as well.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
There's an online feature and there's an offline feature. So if you have the Xbox 360 and you want to play Halo, you can play Halo all you want in your living room with your friends. You don't have to go online. What Representative Bigham's bill goes after is the part of it where you're online and having conversations with people you don't know. So this does not say that sex offenders cannot play games. They can play games that are on their stationary computer. They can play the Wii. They can play the Xbox. They just can't do the online portion of it where you have to register and have a password and you interact with other people.
So, Representative Hortman, then you couldn't do the interactive chess online then or something like that?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, no. I think you have to play with your computer's best skills and not somebody else that you don't know. The point here is that these are people who are registered predatory offenders, and we're trying to take them out of an environment where they have an opportunity to be predators. And when you're playing the Xbox in your living room, we don't have to worry about your a sex offender playing a video game.
Representative Holbrook, did you have another question?
No,
you said you had two.
No, I'm not sure the computer thing even works, and whatever.
Representative Jackson.
I've got a little trouble with what has already been mentioned, that's the assumption that games where, you know, you're supposed to be, it's the whole 18-year-old threshold. I just know that there are plenty of people under 18 playing games, and so with that reality, why not include those? I'm not sure if it's very realistic. And in reality, when we know that there are 15, 16, 17-year-olds playing Grand Theft Auto, even though they can't buy it, you know, this chapter doesn't really speak to that, does it?
Representative Bigham.
I'm sorry, Representative. I don't know that I understood the question you asked.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, my understanding of the bill is you are restricted from those interactive activities that permit people under 18.
Correct,
Bingham.
But is it understood that because you cannot buy Grand Theft Auto if you're under 18, or is Grand Theft Auto in the basket here too? The playing of it.
Representative Bingham.
If you are playing Grand Theft Auto and you are chatting and you are a sex offender, you would be in violation of this law.
Okay.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bigham, I'm just curious if we know, or maybe for the testifier, in sentencing guidelines, if you're found guilty of being a sexual predator, does a judge have the ability to enforce something like this legislation as far as sentencing right now upon an individual?
Representative Bigham.
Mr. Chair, I'll let Mr. Boyd answer that one.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, a judge, if the judge were to place if the judge were to place somebody on probation and set conditions of probation, a judge could impose these exact same conditions. That would require the judge to do that in each and every case for each and every sex offender. And this bill takes away that requirement and just places a uniform prohibition on them all. If a judge sentenced somebody to prison for an offense, the judge loses the ability to set conditions, but when the person is released, the Department of Corrections does have the ability to set conditions of parole.
Representative Chance.
But isn't that true that each case is different, and therefore that's why a judge has the power and the option to identify conditions that he or she wishes a defendant to abide by?
Mr. Voigt, I think he's asked
either one of the testifiers.
Mr. Voigt.
Mr. Chair, a judge does have that authority. And if... And it's true that he has this authority even without this law. As I asked the question earlier, that the judge, without having this law, can say, here's a condition of your probation. Isn't that right?
Mr. Boyd.
Mr. Chair, Representative Champion, yes. As I said previously to this question, yes.
Representative Tamar.
Thank you, Mr. I wasn't going to get involved in the conversation here, but I just want to make sure from something Mr. Boyd said earlier. As I read page 5 of the bill, this only deals with level 3 sexual, level 3 predatory offenders, not any individual who is registered as sex. And if that's the case, I don't even know why we're talking about it. It's a no-brainer. Well, we support it. But if you, you know,
Representative Paymer, my understanding of the whole testimony has been the opposite.
Well, look at page 5 of the bill.
Mr. Voigt, you...
5.31.
Mr. Voigt?
Mr. Chair.
That's a different section.
The prohibition from social networking websites applies to all registered sex offenders.
It's
an amendment to section 243.166, which applies to all persons required to register as a sex offender. When you go down to the bottom and look at the amendments on lines 5.34 through 6.1, that's an amendment to a different statute, 244.05, and that applies to any offenders released on intensive supervised release, which means sex offenders who have gone to prison and are being released on parole.
Representative Hamer, I think it's clear that the section we're talking about is not limited, only the part down F in subdivision 6 deals with only level 3, which is completely different part. Is there any opposition to this bill?
Can I?
There was
just
a Mr.
say one last
Estrom
thing,
called
Mr.
in.
That Nancy Fabian of the Jacob Wetterling Resource Center was unable to come and testify today, but they are in support of the bill.
Okay. Mr. Estrom, are you? Please come forward. Is there any other opposition to the bill? Okay.
I think
Mr. Estrom, you can sit down. Please state your name first.
Yes, my name is Ishim Estrom. Ishim. It's Ishim.
Estrom. Ishim Estrom?
Yes. Okay. I represent the reform sex offender law in Minnesota. It's a kind of organization which unites some sex offenders, people who is not on the register and family members. For example, I came from former Soviet Union 12 years ago. It's a political refugee and human rights violation, and Jewish political refugee. And I think for the Minnesota last state who passed sex offender law right now, because if you compare it with another state like Texas or Iowa, they already passed like residency restriction. I don't know, so many laws I think this kind of law, it's a really bad thing to do, because what we're doing here, we just create a group of parias and then feed them on all right, then they cannot find jobs and anything. So if this record of like sex offenders, nobody will hire you. Then what? Then those people, like, and then we try to apply to a floor. I think the floor is kind of worthless. It's kind of, I can give you example. Dana Bolt, researcher in Minnesota Research, New England. So she said that rather than fighting a law like this, Bill HF 140, it's better to stop the crimes in the first place by helping children and stop engaging in dangerous self-destructing behavior on the internet in real life. Facebook, a fellow at Garvard University, Human Center for Internet and Society. Bolt wrote her doctoral dissertation on how youth use social media. She finds that kids who are preyed on by adults aren't tricked or forced into it. The kids seek out inappropriate and dangerous situation knowingly, because they are physically wounded. So the kids and predators lose their supply of victims. She asks, why are we so obsessed with registered sex offenders side of puzzle when the troubled kids are right in front of us? Why are we so obsessed with the internet side of the puzzle when so many more kids are abused in their own homes? I feel like this whole conversation has turned into distraction. Money and time is being spent focusing on the things
that wrap it up.
People fear rather than
seconds.
Very real and known risk that kids face. So, I know that there is 20,000 registered sex offenders in Minnesota now. This number is growing. I estimate that with family members, 100,000 people with voting rights, American citizens, affected. And then we start, Minnesota didn't introduce sex offenders law like last 2 years. Then I see it starts. It's first floor.
Okay.
What follows, I don't know, because I saw a residential restriction proposal in Minnesota Public Radio, and
Mr. Estrom,
I don't know.
Thank you for your testimony. We have to go on because we have another bill waiting.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we've really discussed this bill quite thoroughly. I think people
are quite aware. I think it's
For example, we just need to go on. We understand your opposition and why, and we have to go ahead and everybody's discussed this, and we're going to vote on it now. So, Representative Hillstrom renews her motion to pass House File 130 and be referred to public safety.
As amended,
and re-refer it to public safety. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Representative Bingham, I believe it. The noes have it.
Division.
Okay. There's a division. All in favor, raise your hand. All opposed, raise your hand. It fails, Representative.
Okay.
So, bill fails?
Yep.
That's it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can you just announce what the vote was?
Representative Westrum, I'm sorry. What did you say? 6-6, Representative Westrum. Representative Atkins, who would like to move the Representative Atkins bill? Representative Johnson moves House File 103. Representative Atkins, and is this where? Representative Atkins, my understanding is this goes to no more policy, just to finance?
Correct.
Okay. Representative Atkins, sorry, go ahead and present your bill.
Mr. Chair, I wasn't sure which finance committee. Did you say
where it goes?
Well,
it just goes to finance.
Does it go to state government finance? Is it going to...
Actually, Representative Holberg, that's up to Representative Carlson to decide.
Okay. Mr. Chair, if I might, as the author, do you know the fastest this lovely piece of work is going to take?
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, I trust you don't mean that facetiously.
Never.
But we've removed the local government component, so my sense is that it will be referred to, re-referred to state government finance.
Okay, thank you. I get to see it again.
Representative Atkins, try again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate your hearing this bill, and members, I appreciate your time. There is an author's amendment, the A090048, that would put it in the shape with which I'd like to proceed.
Representative Atkins, is this the BE1 amendment, or did you have a...
There's a different one?
Mm-hmm.
Which? They're the exact... This one? Okay.
They're the same. 090048.
Correct.
Is that the one? Representative Johnson, do you want to move that? Representative Johnson moves it together in the shape the author wants. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be brief, and I really mean that. I've got a couple points I'll cover, and then I have Linda Paul, who went through the 35W collapse, to provide some testimony. But in times of tragedy, we look to government to be in the victim's corner, not in their way. With the amendments, I'm aware of no formal opposition. I know that there's still some need for greater clarification, but we have worked with the cities to voice some opposition early on to address their concerns, and I believe that we've done it effectively. We've learned a valuable lesson from the 35W tragedy, and that is that the state tort cap dramatically compounded the tragedy that these families and victims had already been through. The state is in a much better position to address the financial losses and damages of individual victims and their families than those individuals are, particularly if the state's responsible. So this bill removes the state tort cap. The caps still will apply to municipalities, however, just as it always has. The bottom line is that this is about accountability. If the state is responsible for a claim, whether it's $1 million or $10 million, it's much better that the state should take accountability and responsibility for that and put it on 2 families or 5 families or 20 families, many of whom might be forced into bankruptcy or into, I'm trying to be brief, I can give you example after example of families after the 35W tragedy that had to have bake sales and fundraisers just to try to make ends meet. And instead, then they had to come through this long, difficult process, make it easy for us to go through. But we put them through months and months and months of hearings and uncertainty and anxiety before they were able to finally be compensated. And even now, they're still going through that. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Linda Paul, who can testify with some firsthand experience that she's been through.
Ms. Paul?
Ms. Paul?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Chair. Yes. My name is Linda Paul, and I am a survivor of the 35W bridge collapse. Hopefully the legislature and the citizens of Minnesota will never again have to endure a catastrophe of that magnitude. There will always be claims against the state, and undoubtedly some of them will involve multiple victims. One thing this legislature can do to make the process less stressful for future claimants is to eliminate the aggregate cap on claims. Prior to August 1st, 2007, I had never been in a major automobile accident, and I had no idea what impact it would have upon my life. The severity of my injuries were such that it took 3 months before I was even able to return to a light-duty job with my now former employer, Hirschfield. During that time, I was totally dependent upon my husband and my family members to help me deal with the day-to-day tasks that most of us take for granted. Added to that were numerous visits to multiple doctors, phone calls from insurance adjusters, visits by investigators, paperwork to be filled out, and a constant stream of questions to be answered. And I cannot imagine how victims who did not have families and friends like I did were able to cope with their situations. Shortly after the bridge collapse, I became aware that caps existed in Minnesota statute limiting the liability of the state. This surprised me, as I'm sure it did many Minnesotans. I'm grateful that Representative Brian Winkler and Senator Ron Latch took the initiative to address those inequities so that the 172 collapse victims would not have to share the $1 million cap, approximately $5,800 each. One of the few reassurances my husband and I have is the knowledge that we will soon receive compensation from the State Bridge Collapse Fund. Over the last year and a half, we have drained our retirement savings. In addition, our monthly expenses now include almost $1,000 for health insurance through COBRA. That became necessary after my light-duty position at Hirschfield was eliminated when I was unable to return to my job as a designer because of my injuries. It terrifies me to be unemployed in an economy that every day is looking more and more like the Great Depression. Last year, the caps caused sometimes bitter division amongst the bridge survivors. This placed an unnecessary burden upon a group that should have been united in their efforts. There was a faction that believed that there should be no caps, individual or aggregate. For the most part, this was due to their belief that the state was their only recourse for compensation and that lawsuits against other parties were not possible. Furthermore, they believed that the bridge collapse was not analogous to the Deutsche Dien tragedy and saw no problem with unlimited awards to victims of the bridge collapse when the Shadeen family only received $300,000. Future victims of malfeasance by the state should not have to fight over a limited aggregate cap. Last year, the legislature understood the logic of eliminating the cap for the victims of the 35W bridge collapse, and that same logic should justify the elimination of the cap once and for all.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Atkins, you're done with your presentation.
With that, we'd be happy to stand for any questions or
Representative Holberg, it looks like you're ready to ask a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm guessing this bill's probably going to get to go to transportation, too, given the change in policy on the Trunk Highway Tort Fund as well.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, we'd be happy to go anywhere that we need to go.
Well, I'm just looking forward to probably hearing this three times. So.
Well, she's the chair, Representative, what you said, it's a lovely bill. So.
But first of all, I'll tell you right up front, I really have a bias against putting findings in law. I don't see the need for it. And given our current situation, I find a statement somewhere in here where you talk about the state being able to the state has the fiscal capacity and ability of to absorb the cost of and pay for multiple claims. I'm not so sure, given our budget situation, I'd agree with that statement in general. I think that there can probably be made a case, at least from my perspective, of maybe changing the amount. But when you say that the bridge situation is so unusual that unable to be anticipated, and that the legislature was able to work through a process to take care of it, I mean, this is a balance between the state is basically the taxpayers, and to be able to have some control over the amount of money going out for various claims protects the taxpayers. So I'm just, you know, I guess I'm disagreeing with your assertion that there shouldn't be no cap, because I think the risk to the state is something that we can't anticipate.
Chair, Representative Action.
Chair, Representative Holberg, just a couple of points. One is that if the state were to choose to insure against this risk, they'd have the ability to do that, just like any other entity or business or individual would. Secondly, is we use the 35W bridge collapse as an example because it's fresh in our minds, but think of a situation where you have a young child that is rendered a quadriplegic in a car accident caused by a MnDOT employee. Accidentally, they didn't intend to harm him. But the anticipated medical bills, $10 and $15 million over the course of a lifetime. Who should be in a position to handle that? Should we put that all on that individual family? Or would it be better to hold accountable the state of Minnesota and our employee for doing that? And if we choose to go out and insure against that risk, that I'd be fine with that too. But when you look at the balance between the two, I'd much rather have the state and the $5 million of us than put it all on the backs of a family or a child.
Right. And Mr. Chair, I mean, like I said, I can see some justification for changing the cap. I don't know when it was last changed. Maybe you know that. But having no limit whatsoever, I think, makes me a little nervous. And with that, so I'm
and Representative Atkins, I think I had heard that somebody told me, I thought it was you, that we weren't lifting the caps on individuals, but we are taking off all caps, both on individuals, it looks like, and the total from a single occurrence. My concern is what happens to the state if we have some state employee that causes a leak of a dangerous gas, and, you know, let's say it's in Duluth, 50,000 people are damaged on average day. The people of Duluth are really enraged at the state, and the jury's come back with $500,000. That's $25 billion, twice what we get in all income to the state in 2 years or something, in a year. So that was my concern. But
sure, I think it's a fair concern. When we balance the abilities of the state against if we are in a position where as a state or an employee of the state we cause $50 million or $100 million in harm, would I rather have the state pick up that tab? Would you rather have the state pick up that tab? Or would you rather bankrupt those individual families? When we do a balance, an equitable balance, I'd much rather err on the side of those families and ask that you ask yourself that question as to how we would best address that. We don't have out-of-control juries in Minnesota. We also have, in existing law, we have some protections in terms of the amount of the appropriation. If you read from lines 2.24 through lines 3.13, it's already, first we look to the individual agency. If that there's a money available that doesn't hinder the agency's operation, then it gets paid out of there. If we go beyond that, then it goes to the that they can only pay part of the claim. Then we go to the commissioner. If we can only, if there's still not enough money, then it's the money appropriated to the commissioner for that purpose. So there's still some controls with respect to it, but we don't put an artificial cap of whether it's 1.2 or 1.5 or whatever the case may be, when we might have a situation arise where we have 20 claims or 200 claims.
Well, Representative Atkins, as you know from doing a lot of PI work, there's in reality caps on people's insurance if you're suing some private company or not. But Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, I share your concern, Representative Holbrook's concern, but Representative Atkins, I really like your bill. I think it makes a lot of sense. For years I've said, why should government get this low immunity that the private citizen and the private business out there has to buy insurance for. And I like the direction you're going. I think there's a way to find a larger cap, if you will, as you go through the process. But I'm fully supportive of what you're doing here today, and I think it's time that the state has to not give itself preferential treatment that the citizen doesn't always have, and necessarily doesn't really have, because the state does cause harm sometimes. One other question I've got in the bill, it talks about if the courts would find it unconstitutional, it reverts back to the cap, because we're leaving it in place for the municipal units of government. Can you explain a little more of what that's doing? And I'm reading it off the summary from House Research. And why don't we raise the caps for the local units of government, and they do what everybody else has to do? You either buy insurance to backfill your risk, or you make sure you don't screw up and harm people.
Mr. Chair and Representative Westrom, the basis for that is that we've got a number of municipalities that range in size from, I think, 61 people up to, the city of Minneapolis, which has a couple of million folks. And that, unlike the state, not all of those municipalities are in a position where they'd be able to exist without the cap. So we found, actually, I credit Senator Latz. He figured out language with the cities. That in the event that it violates an equal protection clause or along those lines, that we will revert back. But this is our best efforts to try to recognize that the state is in a much better position than individual families or victims. But a small municipality, 60 people or a couple hundred people, may not be in a better position than an individual family.
Mr. Chair,
Representative
Atkins, Representative Atkins, I appreciate that explanation. I might encourage you, as you're going through, if something happened in St. Paul, I'm not sure that it's a big enough area that the cap may cause the same unintended consequences as what's happened to your witness in the tragedy of the 35W Bridge. So I would just encourage you to maybe find a sliding scale, if nothing else. I understand the municipality is 61. The risk of them having a claim of over $1.2 million or $1.5 million is much less, and it gives them protection. But as you get bigger as a municipality, the risk of having a larger occurrence that's going to affect more people is there, and I don't think we should, as elected officials, give government the preferential treatment. So I think you understand the trend on that, but maybe there's a way to stagger that or step it up as you get to a larger size unit of government, 2,500, 5,000, 50,000,
etc. Representative Atkins, did you have a response? No, Mr. Chair, I will share Representative Westrom's concerns with the cities that we've been visiting with, as well as with Senator Latz, and I appreciate your comments.
Okay. Thank you. We're out of time, and Representative Johnson moves the bill 103 to, as amended, to pass and be referred to finance. All in favor, say aye.
You never asked if there was any opposition testimony.
I'm sorry, and I have that written down. Is there any opposition to this bill? Okay, we can go back to the Representative Johnson moves House File 103 as amended to pass and be referred to finance. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Carries. We are now adjourned.